First of all, we're going to listen to Steve Cook on the use of humour in Jesus' parables. I won't take any more of Steve's time. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone, again.
Morning, Steve.
I'll just give a bit of an introduction as to why I became interested in the subject of Jesus' use of humour. I've been looking at the teachings of Jesus for probably 30 years. So about 30 years ago, I was asked to speak at a young people's class on the life of Christ. And we did a series of classes, and we met together once a month for about 4 or 5 years, I think, going through the life of Christ. And we'd get probably 100 young people at a time together, maybe I think sometimes more, crowd them into someone's home and did the life of Christ. And for me, that began a love affair with the Gospels. My favourite part of the Bible would be the Gospels. People tell me you shouldn't have a favourite part of the Bible, but I don't know. But for me, my favourite books of the Bible are Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And I just love them. And out of that series of classes that I was doing way back then, I discovered there's a whole lot of things about Jesus' methods, his teaching techniques, which I just didn't understand. And I wanted to learn more and more about them. Got a lot of books on the subject and started to read. The first commentary reader that helped me the most back in those early days was Alfred Edersheim's Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah. Now, Edersheim was a Jew, understood the rabbinic writings very well. He became a Christian, and then he wrote this commentary and a couple of volumes on the life and times of Jesus, but explaining things from his knowledge of Judaism and from the Talmud and so on. And the festivals, and brought that information to it, which I just thought was great, and I still use it as a regular reference. That's began my love affair with trying to understand what was behind the teachings of Jesus, and realised that Jesus was Jewish, and so he uses Jewish ways of teaching because of his Jewish background. A couple of sources which I found very helpful was a couple of books by Kenneth Bailey. Kenneth Bailey is an Anglican bishop who served for many, many years in Syria. And he got to understand the Middle Eastern way of life. He's written some books about the teachings of Jesus against a Middle Eastern background. And so when Jesus talks about banquets and so on, he tells you what a banquet is like in the Middle East and what was going on. And it fills in the gaps for us, those of us who have no idea what Middle Eastern life is like. And another author, Robert Stein, wrote a couple of books, The Difficult Sayings of Jesus and The Methods and Message of Jesus' Teaching. And he alerted me to the fact that Jesus actually used some humour. Now, this I found fascinating, and I started to explore this more and more, and Jesus' use of humour. And now as I read the Gospels over and over, I find things, every now and again I think that's humour, Jesus used humour. Things that now, 20 years ago, would have had no idea was humour. And I just want to explore some of those with you this morning, some of those things where I think that Jesus was very humorous. He was obviously a very popular speaker. I mean, crowds of people followed Jesus for days, sometimes without food. And, a couple of occasions, the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000, where people have followed Jesus for a long time, and the disciples said, well, maybe we should break up so they can go and eat, because people had followed Jesus for long periods of time. Now, there's obviously reasons for why people would do that, and he would have the attention of his audience. It was who he was one thing. What he taught was obviously another, but I think how he taught was also very important. Jesus had a lot of excellent teaching techniques that held the attention of his audience. And so this morning I want to explore the how he taught part. Now I think Jesus used a lot of techniques, and I used to get the impression that from my early Sunday school days that Jesus just kind of wandered around and he'd see a sower, so he'd tell a story about a sower. And then he'd see a couple of cattle, so we'd talk about yoke and oxen being yoked. And he'd see something else, and so he'd tell a story about that. And so things just came to his mind as he saw them. But the more I've looked at this, the more I've realised that Jesus' talks are very well structured. I think he spent a lot of time in preparation. There's a lot of contemplation, meditation, careful thought and planning went into Jesus' sermons, the way he delivered his stories. So when he told a story about a sower, he'd thought about that a long time. It wasn't just that he saw a sower and thought, oh, okay, that's a good analogy here, I'll use that. I mean, he'd thought about that and very, very thoroughly and used that. Jesus uses poetry, some very complex Hebrew poetic forms throughout the Gospels. And poetry is very common in the Bible. You read the King James Version, you don't see it. Some of the modern translations will put some of the poetry there and step it out so it becomes more obvious, especially in the prophets. But unfortunately, not too many translations actually show the poetry in Jesus' sayings. Some of them are very obvious. Ask and you will find. Ask and you receive. Seek and you'll find. Knock and the door will be opened unto you. That's the first stanza. The second stanza takes the same 3 points. For he who asks receives. He who seeks will find. And him who knocks, the door will be answered. And it's Hebrew poetry. It's parallelism. So you take 3 lines, 1, 2, 3, then you repeat them, 1, 2, 3. And that's an obvious one, but there's lots of those throughout the Gospels where Jesus uses poetry in very structured forms. And he does it for, I think, some very clear reasons. The first being, it's memorable. I don't want to get sidetracked on the poetry, because that's a whole lesson in itself, talking about poetry, and it's excellent. But sometimes there's a crossover where there's poetry and human together. But this morning, I just want to look at the poetry. You know, every culture has its own unique style of humour. You know, I can tell you a joke now, you know, an Australian joke, and there'll be a few people in this room that just won't get it. You know, because you know, Americans, you know, just don't understand Australian humour. You know, I think British humour is closer to Australian, but there's some things that you just won't get. You know, and if I tell British humour and Australian humour are very similar in many ways. If I tell a joke that involved local politicians, Brits still wouldn't get it because they don't know the background behind it. They don't understand who we're talking about and so on. So every culture's got its own humour, and things are lost in translation. So we're going to lose whatever humour was there in Jesus' sayings. We're going to lose so much of it because we don't understand the background. We don't understand the way of telling a funny story. We don't understand how they delivered a punchline. We don't understand the characters involved and so on. There's just so much of the background that we've lost and things that we miss. But there's enough of it there that I think we can find and can rediscover. You know, poetry, humour can be based on all sorts of things that we find funny. History, politics, religion, the kind of food we eat, popular personalities, the climate, all those sorts of things go into telling a great story and a funny story. So there's about 3 main characteristics, I think, that we can identify that were characteristics of Jewish humour of the first century. And these 3 characteristics we find come together in Jesus' story. Sometimes they come together, sometimes they stand alone. But just look at these 3 characteristics. The first is exaggeration. Now, exaggeration, not all exaggeration is humorous, but exaggeration is a common feature of Jesus' humour. And there's 2 main types of exaggeration. There's what we could call overstatement. We're just saying, you're just overstating something in order to forcefully bring home a truth. For example, and this is not a humorous example, but it's an example of overstatement in Jesus' sayings. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. Now, if Jesus was meaning and intending that we should take that literally, then we should have a lot of one-eyed, one-handed Christians around. No one takes that literally. We say, well, that's just an overstatement. Jesus overstated his case, just made his point. And he makes the point very well by doing that, by overstating that. And we recognise that as an overstatement. What he's saying is that we should do whatever it takes to avoid sin. You know, even if you have to take out your eye or cut off your hand. You do whatever it takes to avoid sin, is what he's saying. So he uses his exaggeration. Another example of that kind of overstatement, again not humorous, is where Jesus says, if a man comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Would you get that? You have to hate your mother and your brother and your sisters. If you don't, you cannot be your disciple. Now, how many Christians love their mother? Well, you know, they're all damned because you cannot be his disciple unless you hate your mother, is what he's saying. But then he goes on to say, he talks about how we love him. He's not saying that we must hate the people that are closest to us, but rather he's overstating that position in order to make his point very forcefully. The point that he's making is that compared with the love that we have for him in order to be his disciple, any other expression of love by contrast is hatred. So he's saying the love that you have for me is so great, so intense. Any other kind of love, even the greatest love you can think of, by comparison is hatred. That's the kind of love we have for him, or I have for him, to truly be his disciple. So it's an overstatement, just to emphasise the contrast, so that we get the point. He's not telling us to take that literally. The second type of exaggeration that's used by Jesus, I think very, very forcefully, and this is, I think, a very popular characteristic of Jesus, and he uses this it very humorously, very often, is what we call hyperbole, which is gross exaggeration. Now, we might think of exaggeration as a bad thing. My mother told me a million times not to exaggerate. And we might think, you know, we shouldn't do that, but Jesus exaggerates a lot, you know, and I'll give you some examples. And some of these are funny. Unfortunately, because we read the Bible so often, and we're so familiar with it, some of these sayings of Jesus we've read 1,000 times. And so, and we get terribly serious about them. You know, we look for the deeper meanings and think, oh, well, okay, I've heard that explained before. There must be something even deeper. And we just get very serious and we dig down, channel in, and we're trying to find the deepest thing. But on the initial reading of some of these parables, they're very, very funny, some of the stories of Jesus. But because we get so frightfully serious about all this, as we're trying to study if we can find the deeper meanings, we can lose the initial impact it had. Now, I've been to Pakistan a few times and done some preaching there, and they're great people. And some of the people in our group in Pakistan are very well educated. You know, they've got master's degrees in English literature and political science and bachelor's degrees in theology and so on. And at the other end, we've got people who are illiterate as well, can't read a word at all. And so what they rely on is their memory. And some of the illiterate people can quote the scripture more accurately than the people with theology degrees and so on, because they have to rely on their memory to get it all. And so, and they lap up the stories of Jesus very well, because they're very easy to remember. And I can remember on one occasion in Pakistan talking about some of the sayings of Jesus, and a room full of people were just rolling in laughter, because they could see the stories were very funny, because for some of them, they'd heard the stories for the first time. And when they'd heard them for the first time, they immediately recognised, this is really funny. But when we read it for the thousandth time, and looking for that deep meaning, we miss the point completely. Here's a couple of examples of where Jesus uses hyperbole, gross overstatement, to make his point. You blind gnats, you blind guys, you strain out a gnat, but swallow a camel. Is it literal? You swallow a camel, right? Obviously, a gross overstatement. You strain out a gnat, but swallow a camel. Now, we've got a very condensed version of the sayings of Jesus in the Gospels. We don't have the full story. Paper was expensive. It cost a year's wages to buy enough paper to write the New Testament out. So, you know, it's very expensive. So you don't say when you're writing the Gospels any more than you have to say. So we get a very condensed version. Now, Jesus may have told these stories as longer stories. He may have acted them out, used gestures and all sorts of things. So we've got a condensed version, I believe, of some of these. And I think the way he told the story, the way he perhaps acted it out, it may have been hilarious. You know? And I'm not trying to suggest that Jesus was just a funny guy, he was a comedian. I'm not doing that at all. What I'm trying to suggest is that Jesus used devices that made his talks memorable, so that people were going to get the point and they're going to keep the point for a long time, and they could easily transmit it on to the next generation. You know, you strain a gnat but swallow a camel. And there's a pun in there as well. If Jesus was speaking Aramaic, which I believe he probably was, he would have said you strain a gambler but swallow a gimel. You know, so there's a pun there as well. In there, but imagine how, you know, if he would have acted out, you know, talking about these hypocrites, you know, as he said, oh, look, you know, you pour yourself a cup of tea and you get a strainer and you pour it through very, very carefully so that you don't get a little mosquito in there, you know, but at the same time you'll swallow a whole camel, you know, because you may have told the story like that rather than just in a very matter-of-fact kind of way. And people would have, oh, yeah, right. And they get the point, you know. Yeah, that's hypocrisy, you know, where you tithe your mint and your cumin from your garden at the same time, but you forget the weightier matters of the law. That's what Jesus said on another occasion. You know, but here, he tells the same, makes the same point, tells it in a way where he uses some humour and has this gross overstatement about swallowing camels. While we're on the subject of camels, you'd know that other very well-known, very famous saying of Jesus, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man into the kingdom of God. Now, I've heard some very serious explanations of this one as to what it means. As, you know, I've heard it suggested the word for camel here is very similar in Aramaic to the word for rope, and so therefore it's probably been written down wrong, which is probably said it's easier for a rope to go through the eye of a needle. Because, I mean, that you can imagine, you know, you could try and get a very thick thread through the eye of a needle, and it's difficult. And that's probably what Jesus said. Or I've heard another explanation, and that there was a small gate in the gates of Jerusalem called the Eye of the Needle. And so for a camel to go through, it would have to take all its baggage off, get down on its knees and go through to get through the Eye of the Needle. So what it's really saying is it's a bit of an inconvenient process. You try and get to the city before the gates close, so you can just take your camel through the main gate, because if you got there late, Then you've got to actually take the baggage off your camel, get your camel down on its knees and get through the small gate. That's difficult. Jesus isn't saying this is difficult. Because the words aren't the immediately follow. Jesus says, with man, this is impossible. He's saying it's impossible for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. So that's his point. It's not difficult. He's not talking about, you know, taking your time. I'm not talking about unburdening yourself. He's saying it's impossible. And I think it'd be funny. This is the way he tells that story would be funny. People would laugh at that. Yeah, of course it's impossible for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. There's a twist. Another aspect of Jewish humour, probably a lot of humour, I think in our humour as well, is you get a twist. That's what makes things sometimes funny. The punchline at the end is not what you expect. And there's a twist here because the Pharisees had this belief. They had a form of the prosperity gospel. They believed that if you obey the commandments of God, God would bless you. And you would be prosperous. So therefore, if you want to see who are the people who are truly doing God's will, you look around and see who are the richest people. They're the people that God has blessed. Therefore they're God's favourites. They're the righteous people. If you want to see who are the people who are the worst sinners, look for the poor. They're not blessed because they're not keeping the law of God. And so the Pharisees were rich, generally. And they just proved their point. We're rich. We keep the law. We're blessed. You're poor, you don't keep the law, you're being punished for that. And so, and I think this is, for me, I think this is one of the devastating parts of the prosperity gospel, how it's preached today, is that people's faith can be destroyed because I think I'm not prospering, I have not been blessed, therefore I'm not in God's favour, and people can lose their faith. I mean, if I go to Pakistan and preach the prosperity gospel in Pakistan to people who are amongst the poorest in the world, I'm going to get a lot of blank faces. People think, well, we've got no hope. And Jesus is talking to people against this background, people who believe that the rich were God's favoured and the poor were being punished for their sinfulness. And he says, it's impossible for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. And the disciples say, raise this and say, well, who then can be saved? If the rich can't be saved, who then can be saved? And Jesus says, with man this is impossible, but with God all things are possible. Jesus is saying God can do miracles. God can even save rich people. That's a real twist for them. They were thinking the rich were saved, the poor were damned. He says God can do the impossible. He can save these rich people. And the way he told that, it's not the kind of story we're going to be rolling around laughing at. It's funny, but there's humour in that. It's light-hearted, and the way Jesus would say that, God can even save these Pharisees, if only. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? Now, I remember describing this parable to a group in Pakistan who had not heard it. Well, many of them had not heard it before. I mean, they're new Christians, and some of them had come from Islamic backgrounds. And they were laughing, as when I was describing what it meant to have a plank in your eye. So you just imagine, somebody is just, oh, I've got something in my eye. Can you just have a look? What's in my eye? Can you think? He's like, oh, yeah, I can see something in your eye. Oh, there you are. Yes, you've got something in your eye. Oh, just, where's your eye? Oh, yeah, you've got something. Because you've got this huge thing in your own eye. And are you going to let a guy like that anywhere near your eye, who's got this? So, you're laughing. Jesus' audience laughed when they heard this, about this. And they understood hypocrisy. That's what hypocrisy is. And Jesus is saying, we're all a bit like that, aren't we? Eager to give advice to other people, but blinded by our own faults. How can we give advice to other people when we can't even see our own faults? We're blinded by it. So, we rush into helping situations where our advice can be more damaging than helpful very often. Because we're blind to our own weaknesses. And I think what Jesus is doing by using humour is he's saying that, he's using this technique because if we laugh at ourselves, then we're more open to receiving the truth and to being guided to a better way. It's a very good device, I think, for a teacher to use, to use some humour because it can relax the audience. And if you tell a joke and then the audience becomes relaxed, then you can go in with a heart-hitting truth. And people are more receptive to that because we're kind of relaxed. Whereas if you're going in, this is all going to be all terribly serious. People are thinking, well, I'm not sure about this. I don't know where this guy's coming from. And everything they hear, they're thinking, not sure. So you're on our guard. But, you know, if you get someone to say, oh, okay, this guy's just funny, you know. You sit back and, oh, you laugh at the jokes, this is good. Then he comes in with a hard-hitting truth and, oh, didn't see that coming, but, wow, he's right, isn't he, you know. I'm a bit like that. I go in, I offer advice to people where I'm just blind, oblivious to my own faults. And I do it all the time. Always giving advice where it's best, probably best and better that I don't. So I'm receptive to the truth because he softened me up, prepared me for the blow. And then the blow comes in more gently, yeah, as well. I think that's why he does it. You might be able to think of other examples. The blind leading the blind. Mate, funny if you've acted out, describe it, about blind people falling into a ditch because of being led there by someone who's blind. All sorts of sayings where Jesus uses an overstatement, hyperbole, exaggeration. So that's the first device I think Jesus uses quite a lot. Exaggeration, those two forms. The other is an unusual or an unreal storyline. Any unusual or unreal storyline is often an indication that humour is going to be involved. The whole story doesn't have to be humorous, but Jesus may use an element of humour in order to direct our attention to the main point. It's a way of saying, don't pay too much attention to the details in the story. After all, it's just the story, but I want you to get the main point. In some of Jesus' stories, they can be longish stories, longer than just a normal parable. Like, there is a difference between a parable and a story, and a story is a lengthy parable very often. And we're trying to find all these hidden meanings, what every element in the story is about. But what I'm about to suggest is that sometimes all these elements don't have a particular meaning of their own. They're just there to get us to the main point. And we don't get that main point unless we have a story that goes beforehand. So that's not the details of the story that are necessarily important. It's the main point. We can miss the main point if we pay too much attention to the details. And so when we have an unusual or an unreal storyline, it alerts us to the fact that this is like going to be humorous, probably. Or this is the story here. He's not telling an actual event, so you're not describing an actual event or something. He's telling a story. Jesus was a great storyteller. You know, you often know when there's a joke coming, just by the way it starts. Three men walk into a bar, an Englishman, an Irishman, and a Scotsman, and the barman says, is this some kind of joke? So you know when the difference between a joke and a story. You can tell them from the first line very often. So Jesus has some of his stories that they're unreal, you know. So I think the parable of the 10 bridesmaids is one of those. It's unreal. And people would have realised right from the start. This is not a true story here. This is a joke, you know, or something. They know it's not a true story from the way it starts. There's 10 bridesmaids. 5 are wise, 5 are foolish. The 5 wise ones are well prepared for the wedding. The unwise ones were unprepared and weren't allowed to get into the wedding banquet. You know, and in our Western attention to detail, we go through and we make everything in that story mean something. And I think miss the point. But can you see anything that's unreal or unusual about the story of the 10 bridesmaids going to... Has anyone here ever been involved in a wedding? In a wedding, either organising one, been a bride, been a groom, been a bridesmaid, best man? You know, probably most of us at some stage in our life will get to be in one of those roles at least. You know, a bride, a groom, have to, you know, pay for a wedding or, you know, be a bridesmaid or something. So we've been there and we know how much preparation goes into it. Now, even in our own culture, a lot of preparation goes into a wedding. In theirs, a wedding would last for days. In ours, it lasts for a few hours and there's still an enormous amount of preparation goes in. Now, imagine Jesus told this story, you know, where he says, you went to a wedding and you got to the wedding and the bride was about to walk into the church and says, oh, I forgot to get flowers. Oh, what am I going to do? And then, anyway, she goes in, she gets down the aisle, gets to the end, the groom says, I've got to buy a ring. And then you get to a wedding reception, and then the father of the bride says to the mother of the bride, did you organise the reception? She says, no, I thought you were doing the reception. You're like, can you imagine? That wouldn't happen. It wouldn't happen. The bride would forget the flowers, the groom would forget the ring, the parents would forget the reception. It wouldn't happen. But this is the story Jesus is telling here. Because these events were very well prepared. You know, they went for days. A lot of planning went into them before. The bridesmaids knew exactly what their roles were. And part of the role of the bridesmaids was they would have this torch march, this bit of a parade where the bride would be taken to the groom's house, or it was the other way around, but they would have these lanterns for this part that would happen at night. And not only did you just carry lamps to keep the the way bright so people could see where they were going. But they would have all these dances based around these torches, as they would throw the torches to each other and they'd dance around them. And it was all part of the ceremony that, you know, there's all involved. So you'd learn the dance, you'd make sure it was all prepared, you'd be rehearsed, it would be choreographed, the whole thing. A lot of preparation would go into this. And the bridesmaids knew exactly what their roles were. They knew what they had to do. They'd worked on it, they'd practiced it, they'd prepared it, they'd planned it. They wouldn't get to a wedding without oil in their lamps. It would not happen. It just simply would not happen. Like a groom would not forget a ring. A bride would not forget her flowers. The parents would not forget the reception. It just doesn't happen. So in this story of Jesus, he's saying, imagine this. You get 10 bridesmaids, half of them forget their oil. People think, oh, this is a joke, right? Because I know it wouldn't happen. And it isn't. It's a funny story where Jesus tells this story about half of them do forget, and they're unprepared. And he comes in, and there's always a punchline. So he softens this up with a story, ready for the punchline. And what's the punchline of this story? So I tell you, be prepared. That's what the story's about. Remember to buy the ring, get the flowers, prepare the reception. You do that for wedding. So I'm telling you, the Son of Man is coming. Be prepared. You're going to be prepared for a big day in your life, like a wedding. Be prepared for the biggest day in your life, the coming of the Son of Man. That's the point. Now, when we attribute meanings to these things, oh, the light represents this, the oil represents that, the whole story becomes so terribly confused. In my mind, I think commentators make it very, very difficult. A lot of this method of attributing meanings to various elements in a parable goes back to Augustine, who was Augustine? 4th century? Yeah. And, you know, very early on, early in the history of the church, but long after this. And Augustine was really one of those people that contributed a lot to the development of the importance of the clergy. You know, and if the Bible's really easy to understand, then you don't need people to explain it to you. If you make the Bible more difficult, then you've got a job for yourself as a clergyman to unravel it. I'm a bit cynical about some things, you might not be able to tell. But I'm certainly cynical about the development of the clergy. You know, you see, as it happened throughout the centuries, people were creating jobs for themselves, and Augustine did that. He made it all very difficult, so then he could explain it. And only people like him could explain it. And so he attributed meanings to all these things, all these hidden meanings, you know, because you poor ordinary Christians can't understand this. But those of us, you know, with a theology degree, we've got this sorted out and we can explain this to you. So you get all these meanings. And so an example would be, in this story, the oil would be a symbol of something in the Christian life. Some say it's a symbol of having to have the word, or you have to have the spirit. The wise bridesmaids symbolise faithful Christians. The foolish ones represent Christians, you don't have enough of the word or the spirit, whatever you mean you attribute to that, and so on. So if we allegorise Jesus' stories in this way, then we end up with something that's on a different point altogether. It's teaching and taking a different lesson to what Jesus had in mind. But if we analyse this allegorical interpretation, for example, let's say the oil represents the word. And at the second coming of Christ, which is the coming of the bridegroom, some Christians discover they don't have enough of the word. If this was an allegory about the second coming and judgment, how would these unprepared Christians realise that they had too little of the word? I mean, they're going to meet the bridegroom, not quite there yet. They haven't got to the judgment, and he said, well done, good and faithful servant, then turned and said, sorry, you don't have enough of the word, depart from me, you wicked. But they haven't got to that point yet. They're going off to meet the bridegroom. And on the way to meet the bridegroom, they say, oh, we don't have enough of the word. So we better do something about this. So they go to the wise bridesmaids who do have enough of the word, and they say, can you give us some of the word? Now, we're all good Christians here. If someone came to you and said, can you explain the word to me? What would we do? No, sorry, too late. You should have done that yourself. You should have been prepared. Because I'm prepared, I'm going to look good, but sorry, I'm not sharing what I've got with you. Well, if you take this allegorical approach, that's what Jesus is saying. He's saying that the faithful Christians on the way to judgment aren't going to help their brothers and sisters who aren't prepared. So where do we go from there? It just doesn't fit. The wise bridesmaids, you know, are not sharing. And is Jesus commending this? Is Jesus saying, I want to commend this attitude to you, that if you're prepared, don't share it with those who aren't? Not my Jesus. I don't think not the one I've got, the one I've got to know. But then it says, but they say, no, there may not be enough for both us and you. Instead, go to those who sell well and buy some for yourselves. There's not enough. There's not enough of the word. So I think, oh, okay, I'll share the word for you, but sorry, it's not enough. You know, if I explain some of this word to you, then there won't be enough for me. I mean, that doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense. There's not enough of the word. Well, okay, maybe we're wrong with the word. Maybe it's about the spirit. There's not enough of the spirit either. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So this allegoric interpretation of things like this. So I'm well prepared. I've been reading and studying the Bible for a long time, but I'm not going to lift a finger to help you. You'll have to go somewhere else. Where do you go? The bridesmaids are on the way to meet the bridegroom. So if it's the second coming or on our way to judgment, where do they go? I mean, anyone who is going to know the word is there on the way to meet the bridegroom. So they say, no, you're not prepared. Go and buy from the merchant. Where do you buy it? What are you going to do? Go and find a Christian bookshop? Well, there's not going to be no one there because they're on the way to judgment. Yeah? Go and find a church? Well, there's no one there. But in analysing this, you can miss the main point. Be prepared. So Jesus tells a story about being unprepared that they obviously, would have seen as a story, not meant to be taken allegorically. You know, you don't have to make a meaning out of all these points. And comes in with the punchline and be prepared, and they get it. They understand it. We understand that as well. There's a whole lot of other stories, I think, where Jesus uses the same kind of thing, and I don't have time to go through a lot of them, but there's lots of them. I just mentioned a couple. Anthony was talking yesterday about the parable of the sower, a great story, and has a lot of. And this is one of the few stories, there's only two, where actually Jesus interprets in an allegorical kind of way, where he says, well, the word means the seed means this. Yeah, and this kind of ground means that, and that kind of ground means something else. There's only two stories where Jesus actually explains what he means, where he attaches meaning to things like that, which tells me that these stories are the exception, not the rule, where he explains those. But even in the story of the parable of the sower, there's a bit of humour, I think, involved there, where Jesus, because there's this unreal element in the storyline, where he starts off by saying, a sower went forth to sow, and he threw his seed. Some landed on rocky ground, some landed on the footpath, some landed on good ground, and he talks about lands into various kinds of places. And then we immediately rush to work out what they all mean. So I work out whether I'm good ground and whether you're rocky ground or hard, whatever. So we all know where we fit in this. So I know, whether to waste my time on you because you're rocky ground or who I spend my time with because they're good ground and things like that. So I think Christians can tend to use these stories sometimes not for their own benefit to work out where I stand, but also to work out where you stand. So I need to know whether to waste my time on you or not, unfortunately. But Jesus was, when he was living in first century Israel, it was maybe not as dry a country as it is now, but the land was scarce. They were an occupied country. The Romans took what they wanted from the country. They were the occupiers. They took what they wanted. It was any occupied country that people don't have rights in their own land. So you have seed, you plant it. The Romans can take from that what they wanted, the harvest, and so on. It's good land is scarce, and you have to be a good steward for that. You have to look after it and look after it well. You don't waste anything. You're an occupied country, mostly a poor population, and it's a country that parts of it are very barren. You don't waste things. A sower went out to sow. A sower there would go out to sow. He would find the good ground, and he'd take his seeds, and he'd drop the seeds into the good ground. That's how he would sow. He would carefully select the ground, put the seed in the ground. No wastage. But Jesus says, a sower went out to sow, and he took the seed, and he threw it everywhere. Some went on good ground. Some went on rocky ground. Some went on the road. Some went... We thought, well, that doesn't happen. This is a funny story. So they're ready for the meaning that comes through in this. What he's telling us about the sower, the sower here is the word of God, he's saying God is abundantly generous. He's got the word, and he wants to get it out to as many people as possible. He throws it up in the air. The word goes out. Some lands on good ground. Some goes on the roadway. Some goes on rocky ground. God doesn't care. He gets the word out. He doesn't judge people beforehand and say, you're good ground, you're not, I'll give it to you, not to you. God doesn't do that. He just gets the word out there. God's abundant, he's gracious, he's generous. He gets the word out. I think when we preach the gospel, we can be selective. We can look around, what kind of person would respond to this? You know, we work out the kind of person who's most likely to respond. That's who we'll target. We'll get those people. And we aim our message towards certain people. You know, somebody else, you know, we might hear they could be interested and we think, I don't think so. They're not gospel people, really. They're not our kind of people. I don't think they respond. You're wasting your time talking to them. Yeah, we prejudge. We work out what kind of ground is good, what kind of ground is rocky. God doesn't. He throws the seed out. And in the process of that seed sprouting and growing, you know, it'll be determined what kind of ground the seed has landed on. It'll be sorted out then. You don't sort it out in advance. You just get the word out there and so on. So that's another story where I think there's an unusual storyline. People were relaxed when they heard it, so they're more receptive to the meaning, and they could remember that. The third element is Jesus uses punchlines very often. Like any good story, definitely any good joke, it's got to have a punchline. It's got to have a good punchline. I've got a friend of mine who's Danish, and he loves a good joke. You know? And sometimes he'll tell me, oh, he says, we've got this great joke in Denmark. Starts to tell a story, and he gets the end, gets the punchline, and he goes, Schlabernaden Tuten, or something, it sounds like that to me. He says, in English, you'd say, and then he tries to translate it. By the time he's translated Schlabernaden Tuten, it's not funny, you know. He's laughing, you know. I'm not. It's not funny, you know. So if you've got to explain the punchline, it's just not. So, you know, you don't tell a joke if the audience is not going to get the punchline. Or don't you hate it when somebody says, have you heard the joke that ends with, you know, no, yeah. Oh, I'll tell it to you. Oh, forget it. I know the punchline. I don't want to hear the joke. So, it usually means the last line of a joke, the one that really makes us laugh, without the punchline, the joke makes no sense. And Jesus used punchlines, I think, in a very similar way, but with some, you know, important differences. In his story, the final line is not usually the humorous one, but it is the main point. The humour frequently comes earlier in the story, and then the final line will be a serious and heart-hitting point. So the punchline is not humorous, like in our jokes typically, but the humour comes early, the punchline is the heart-hitting point and comes in at the end, very often with a twist. And if we're not sure what the real point of a story is, we should go to the last line and see. You know the parable of the Good Samaritan? You know how it's been interpreted? There's all these sorts of meanings. You know, the in means that, the as means this, the 2 shekels or whatever you pay with pennies, but it means something else, and oil means this, and, you know, it means something. So you get all those things together, and you put it together, and what's the story all about? Well, the story's all about, you know, what is it all about? When you get all that, you know, the story's all about this man who's sees somebody on the side of the road, and he's saying, well, Pharisaic Judaism's wrong, and Levitical Judaism's wrong, and then he puts his bandages, but pours in the oil of the Spirit, you know, and it also takes him to the inn, well, that's the church, and pays the innkeeper, that's the pastor, and you know, so you give meaning to all of this, and then what's the story about? Well, the story's about rejecting Levitical Judaism, and it's about, you know, what's the story about? Somebody came to Jesus and said, who's my neighbour? The story's about who is your neighbour. That's the main point. If any of your interpretations of this story give means take you away from that point, who is my neighbour, then we've missed the point. Our interpretation is wrong. It has to fit in with the main point of the story, who is my neighbour. And that story tells it brilliantly. Often there's an unexpected twist, usually near the end, and it tends to catch the listener off guard. And just when they think they know how the story will end, there's a sudden twist. And by catching the listener off guard, Jesus prepares them for this punchline. And I think one of the best examples that I can think of that is the parable of the lost son, the prodigal son. I think it's a great example. In his story, Jesus describes a young man who's greedy, shows no loyalty or respect for his father, and he's impatient, and he's possibly immoral, and he becomes the hero of the story. So this man, this young man goes to his father and said, you know, Pops, are you going to hang around forever? I've got things I want to do in my life. Are you going to die or what? You know, because if you're not going to die, I can't wait. I want to have a good time now. Can you just give me the inheritance and I'm off? I'm out of here. And the old man said, sure. take your inheritance. Off he goes. So off he goes, blows the lot, and riotous living, immoral, spends his money at pubs and with prostitutes and, who knows, spends it wherever, and runs out. Then he has a hard time, back to the old man. So Jesus is telling the story. We're thinking, rotten kid. I know some kids like that. We do that. You're a rotten kid. And thinking the father's also pretty stupid in the first place to have done this. So he goes back to the old man. And the old man says, "Welcome home. Great to see you. I've been waiting here at the door every day, waiting for you to come home." Gives him a hug. Says, "We're going to have a party." We're thinking, what's wrong with this guy? This guy, the son, he's a good clip around his ears and kick in the backside and told him, "Get out. You've got your inheritance. You've blown it. Wait, gone. Out of here." So people are hearing this story thinking, rotten son, crazy old man, let him do this. And then the other brother comes on and says, hang on, what's going on here? I've been with you all my life, I've been faithful, and served you the whole time, and you've never thrown a party for me." We're thinking, he's the good guy. This guy, he's responsible, a responsible child. He's worked for his father, he's been loyal, he can go and have a good time, he worked for his dad, he didn't think about parties and pubs and brothels, he didn't think about any of that. He worked for his dad, he was loyal, did the right thing, patient, waiting, and this is the kind of son every dad wants to have. And so Jesus is telling the story, and I think, right, now he's telling us how this is the way it should be. And Jesus ends the story with that rotten kid being the hero, and the dad, and the son being told, that he really misses out. There's this twist at the end, really unexpected, and people think, whoa, because he says, this is my son, who was lost, and now he's found. And that's the punchline of the story, that we're lost, and we're found, and God loves us. We're his sons and daughters. That's the punchline of the story. So it's not about being responsible and doing the right thing all the time and, living a kind of a legalistic life where we never step out of line. It's not also not saying that we should just, should spend all our money in pubs and at brothels. He's not saying that either. Because if we, take those details of the story too literally, then we might miss the point. But the main point of the story is here, that which was lost is found, and you celebrate. God celebrates when something that is lost is now found. And this comes as part of a group of stories that talk about things are lost and become found, and then we celebrate. Okay. Probably don't want to tell you more stories because we're out of time. But hopefully I've just started some thoughts in your mind, and now that when you can read the Gospels, you can look through and just see what's the main point, the Jesus story. It's just what's he getting at here? And maybe find some humour. Don't just look for the humour for the sake of finding humour. But if it helps to understand the story and to get the main point, just bear in mind that there could be some humour in there. And look for that just to see whether that helps you understand the story. So don't just go looking for humour for the sake of it. I don't think that's what we want to do. But I think the main reasons for humour in Jesus' teachings are these. Firstly, it's memorable. We usually remember any story that makes us laugh. And, you can go away from a conference and forget a lot of things except a funny story that somebody might have told. If somebody told a good joke, we'll remember that. We remember things that make us laugh. And so Jesus made his audience laugh. And they remembered his stories. And they passed them on for generations and generations. It was 1,500 years before anyone could print them. And for a long time, those stories got passed on. Still today, in illiterate countries, people are passing these stories on orally, And they're very memorable. Jesus' stories are very memorable. Humour is one of those things that makes stories memorable. The second thing about Jesus' use of humour is that humour is interesting and it maintains audience involvement. When if you're listening to a speaker and you're kind of like this, I'm not sure, and then he starts to tell a funny story, we change our posture, and we become more open and we get involved. We might even lean in to hear, Gets audience involvement, you pay attention. When the funny stories come in. So when, it might be rattling off a whole lot of do's and don'ts, you think back like, that's interesting, But then when a story comes, we pay really, you know, really pay attention, we lean in. You know? So Jesus gets his audience involved. He draws them in with these stories. And because of the nature of humour, it tends to keep the attention of the listener, keeps them involved while they're waiting for that punchline. And that's when that's when he comes in with something which is really hard hitting. You know, be prepared, or love your neighbour, whatever it is. A story like this also helps us to focus on the main point. And I think in all the stories of Jesus, there is a main point. We should never miss the main point by attaching all different sorts of meanings to the elements of a story. And some humour in that story helps us to stay focused on the main point. And particularly with Jesus' audience who would have understood Jewish humour of the first century. They understood it. For us, it's a bit more difficult. His audience, they understood it, and that's why he used that as a very clever device. The fourth reason for humour, I believe, is the listener is caught out and therefore is more receptive to the lesson. And finally, it encourages a response. So when we're caught out, perhaps by the story of the speck in the eye or plank in the eye, and we think, oh yeah, that's me. I am a bit hypocritical. I do give advice when I've got my own faults, and I've looked my own faults when I'm giving advice. We can laugh at ourselves. And if we laugh at ourselves, we're more likely to see the application of that point for our own lives. So we can do it. So Jesus is very clever. I think he does it very gently, really. He softens us up and then comes in with a punchline. So we're receptive to that. And then we can apply it to our own lives because we've been receptive. We're off guard, we've heard the point, we're receptive, and we can do it to our own lives. So Jesus wasn't a comedian, but he certainly used whatever device I think was helpful in getting his story through to people. And we retell those stories again and again in our own lives. So I hope that's been helpful, or interesting at least, to have understood how Jesus uses humour in that. And if you come up with some things that where you find some humour in Jesus' things, I'd love to hear from you, so email me or something like that, because I'd love to hear some more of this, because it's been exciting for me to actually find some of these things in the stories over a period of time and finding more, so I'd love to hear some more from you, so it'd be great to get some feedback. Thanks.